Welcome to the Declarations of War podcast, guys. This is episode 38. Thanks for tuning in. Our hosts this time around are Alexei Card, Ninja Turtle.
Hey, guys.
Lord Maldor.
Good evening.
And also from Rooks and Kings, Eldorath.
Hey, guys.
We are very happy to have a Rooks and Kings edition of Declarations of War this time around. First off, I want to give some shout-outs. Ari Danica of Voices from the Void, Lost and Even, hashtag TweetFleet. Most amazing podcast host you could possibly ask for. She's been playing League of Legends with me and a couple other Noir guys. And whenever she's playing a game with us, not only is she good and fun to have on the team, she's really helping out with social media promotion of our new League of Legends stream, own3dtv/AlexeyofCard. So, if you're into League of Legends, check that stream out, and much love to Ari for helping it get off the ground.
Hey guys, Turtle here. I want to give a shout out to the Jagged Alliance. There's a lot of nice guys in there that were pleasurable to work with, and it's too bad that kind of seems one person had to mess that up for all of y'all. So, best of luck in the future. Hope to see you down the road.
Okay, well, usually I only shout if people are aligned the wrong way, but I'll give a shout-out to Hidetoshi, actually. He's a CVAFC we had some nice fights with. And I believe he's actually left the region now, unfortunately. But we had some good battles with him. He's a good guy. And in fact, I'll extend that to all of CVA and Providence. A gentleman to fight, and it's a pleasure.
Yes, I'd like to give a shout-out to him. The U-Band guys who we fly with quite a lot. They're cool people. They join if we need extra numbers and been correct ship vibes and whatnot, so cool bunch.
Speaking of the correct ship type, our poll from last show, what is your preferred ECM ship? The Falcon takes the cake at 44%, the Rook just behind it by only one vote, 38%, and trailing in third, the soon-to-be revamped Blackbird. Now I kind of wonder if that poll will change once the new ECM and cruiser balancing changes go through on the winter patch. I think the Blackbird is going to be much more competitive compared to especially the Falcon. Although, I guess the Rook a little bit, because the Rook doesn't even have the covert cloak bonus. It's just kind of there.
Not really surprised by the results, I guess. I had kind of hoped putting that third option in there that the Falcon might not get as many votes, but clearly people still appreciate the Falcon as their ECM of choice.
I still hold on to the Rook as being the more desirable, although I get that there's some things that the Falcon can do that the Rook just can't, but the Rook is just so much sturdier, man. I hate having my ECM chipped into the pop. It's really annoying. What is the preferred ECM boat for Rooks and Kings? I'm guessing the Tengu.
Well, I think it depends a little bit on the arena. I think if it's the T3 fleet, then, and especially in the wormhole stuff, then the armor Tengu can certainly slot into that and be very effective. But I think in terms of the bigger fleet battles, when we're flying the signature Navpox and stuff like that, I think in those kind of battles it's a bit more difficult to work the ECM into that, because especially when we're fighting Max Alpha, which has mostly been the story of the last 18 months or so, we're having to obviously use high-grade slave sets and all to in the Navpox to really pump up the EHP to 300k, 350k, that kind of stuff. And obviously it's very difficult to get an ECM boat to that, and granted they might last a little bit on the field, but buy us some time, but obviously time isn't the major factor there. It's very difficult to rep the ECM boats. So in our main fleet, we tend not to have that much ECM in terms of dedicated ECM wing.
Most of it's generally ECM drones off the odd ship, just to jam out like key targets, tacklers, and whatnot.
So, what's your strategy in those kinds of fleets? And when you say max alpha, I assume you mean like vastly outnumbered and ships that are doing high damage, like other battleships, right?
Well, when I say max alpha, I mean the opposition is flying max alpha, so it's traditionally the CFC doctrines of maelstroms. And, I mean, they're probably the same would be true for the big Tengu fleets as well. We tend to obviously use the Navpox for range damage projection against the Tengus as well.
And so with no ECM in the fleet, how do you guys get around the problem of enemy logistics? Because fleets of that size generally have a pretty sizable wing of either scimitars or guardians.
Well, first of all, not to say we would never use ECM. Obviously, we might in some situations, but generally, when it comes to breaking hostile logistics, more often than not, it would just be on pure damage, first of all. So let's take the example of a recent fight we had against a big battleship blob which had, you know, I don't know, 30 logistics or something. And there are a number of strategies that one might deploy against that. First of all, there's damage coming in from the NAVPOX. The NAVPOX have their target caller. And then there's damage coming in from tracking dreads, and they have their caller. So obviously they're picking different targets. And then to add to the broadcast spam as well, there's John Caffeine charging like a bull into the middle of their fleet with his smart bombing foon, just trying to create broadcast chaos. So that all of that makes life difficult for the logistics. And then, of course, if a Balgorn or something does get into the Logi blob, then, of course, that's even more chaos.
Yeah, sometime we're going to have to talk in depth about John Caffeine, because I've heard him come up a few times as being a major sort of piece of your psychological warfare approach. I'd love to get into that. But first, I have to talk about our sponsor for this episode, one of two. EVE Timecode. Buy 14 EVE Timecodes, get one free. They've got a promotion right now, Fall Fun 2012, all one word, lowercase, Fall Fun 2012. Put that in when you're doing your checkout, gives you a 5% discount on purchases over $64. EVETimecode.com, where your business counts. You can get yourself some Plex, which you can bet on our next sponsor, which I will talk about after the news segment. If you would like to advertise in Declarations of War, we are still taking sponsors. Contact Alexei of Card in game. Right. Lord Maldor and Eldareth, of the famous Rooks and Kings, probably the best known small gang warfare outfit in EVE, and deservedly so. You guys have not only been in probably some of the coolest fights that you could possibly hope for, but you've also promoted them well through the use of the amazing Clarion Call videos, and your battle reports. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
What have you guys been up to lately? We've seen the Incursion battle report, but what's going on in the PvP world for Rooks and Kings?
Well, in the summer, we've taken a little holiday in the east. So the areas we've been hitting have been Catch, Providence, and Derelict Losec. And that's led to a number of fights in Providence with CVA, some of which, you know, reported on Mitanni.com and all. And they've been nice battles. They've been, I suppose, something to say about CVA. Not that CVA have been our only opponent. We've dropped on AAA and Darkseid and whoever we find around there. But interesting thing about CVA and fighting them is that they present a kind of fleet that's difficult to find these days. Like, one of the battles was against a 220-man Abaddon fleet from CVA. And these days, it's not easy to find a fleet like that, which, of course, doesn't have an instant bat phone, you know, to another 400 people or super caps or whatever. So, therefore, that makes them an interesting opponent, creates some interesting situations on the battlefield.
Would you say they've been your favorite opponent of the last 2 or 3 months?
Yeah, I'd say so. They've sort of the two big fights that we've had with them have been most enjoyable part of this road trip, I think.
They're very, I mean, people perhaps find these days the role playing thing they have unusual. Although I guess when EVE started out, you know, it wasn't unusual at all. I still hear the stories about Hell Gremlin and all of that scene, that sort of nebulous scene from which many of the big PvP entities emerged, and the kind of EVE fiction side, I have the impression, I wasn't there, but I have the impression, reading back to those days, that did play its role. So, and of course they are, I believe, the oldest alliance still existing in the game, still holding space.
Still holding space? Yeah, I think that'd have to be true. I'm not exactly sure what is the oldest. I think it's Ushurakan?
That's true. Ushra Khan probably date back as far. I suppose they are, you know, although they're enemies, they're kind of...
Yeah. Two of the oldest alliances, and quite appropriately, their history has always been intertwined.
Yeah, indeed. And I'm not sure how Ishrakhan doing these days. I don't know too much about what they're up to, but yeah, definitely two of the oldest alliances. And they're quite enjoyable to fight in so far as they put up a good fight. They're very polite and local. They're very friendly. And that makes a change too, you know, that can be fun and Eve.
Certainly. So let's take it back to the beginning, since we've been a little bit of reminiscing here. How long have you guys both been playing? And what did you do when you were starting out? We'll start with LM first.
I've been playing since around 2006. And originally, before I had Rooks and Kings, I was the leader of an alliance called Foundation. And we held the Great Wildlands.
Really? You were a leader of Foundation? I had no idea. Pretty sure we had a contract against Great Wildlands while Foundation was still around.
Oh, that's quite possible. It's a long time ago now, but I think, you know, to some degree, the seeds of, you know, what we do in Rooks and Kings, I mean, you can trace certain elements back there, because obviously we had the early triage gangs there. And actually, there's a strange kind of parallel to the Great Wildlands days here in Providence, you know, fighting in Providence, because they're both NRDS regions. And they have, there's a similar sense that, like in the old days in Foundation, I'd sometimes get bat-phoned in the middle of the night to go and save someone ratting or rescue a carrier. And it's a little different now, of course, in Rooks and Kings. I mean, these days, it's, you know, I'd get a ping or an alert or something in the middle of the night, and it'll just say, log in, you know, be there, give me a ship type, and I'd be there. But I suppose I miss a little bit of the that strange touch that Great Wildlands had, too. Like, when there was a crisis, you know, when someone had warped his carrier to a gate or got himself in trouble somehow at some strange hour of the night, 4 a.m., 5 a.m., they'd often need a triage pilot. And initially, of course, when the triage module first came out, I was the only carrier triage pilot. So then they'd have a problem that they had to get someone to contact me. And usually the man who would do that was a fellow named Nightstar. And he was a quintessentially English gentleman. And it was impossible not to respond in like fashion to that. So he would phone me up in, you know, 4 a.m., 5 a.m., and he'd say, "Hello, it's Nightstar here. Am I disturbing at all?" And of course, judging my sleepy groan, he knows he's disturbing, so there's no point asking it.
But he's a gentleman.
Exactly, he's a gentleman. So I respond in turn, though, and say, no, of course you're not disturbing. How are you doing? Now, that's clearly not the point of the call, because in the background he's got people shouting about their carrier going in low armor and structure, and he wants to describe the crisis going on, but of course he has to respond to my question, because as we mentioned, he's a gentleman. So he says, oh, I'm absolutely fine, I can't complain, it's just another day. And then he's about to tell me about this crisis, this chaos that's going on comms, and the crisis and the carrier and structure, but then he remembers his manners. And he says, "But how are you doing?" And I don't know what to say, because I've just been fast asleep. And obviously, if I say that I've been fast asleep, then it means admitting that he's woken me up and that he's disturbing me. So instead, I'd probably try and remember, you know, some obscure detail like what book I was reading before I passed out. So here I am telling him about a book that he doesn't want to know about and that I don't want to tell him about, while some poor guy is bleeding into structure in his carrier. Then finally, you know, he'd say something like, "Well, if you happen to be around, we may have a pickle on our hands." And I'd say, "Well, what's the nature of the pickle?" And then he'd say, "Well, there seems to be a young gentleman here whose carrier is in trouble, and we're wondering if it's not too late, of course, whether you might be able to rustle up some triage. And, you know, maybe the carrier would live, or maybe the carrier wouldn't live. You know, hopefully I'd be booting up my PC during this time." But somehow no force of heaven or hell could speed up that quaint bat phone. I miss that a little bit. And I see a little bit of that in Providence. You know, you get that that sense of this chaotic NRDS region, which I guess plays into why we quite like CVA. And although we've had some big pitched battles, you know, against them that have been on the news sites and all, it's not like we sit there with Sinos in their, you know, in their mining ops or hunt their ratters or that sort of thing particularly, because, and generally, you know, given two fleets, if there are two fleets going through, we'll tend to hot drop the other one, you know, the one that's not belonging to Provi, which it's become a bit of a running joke actually as we come back from F9E and then we, you know, wave at CVA and local and say, hey, Lamar. And I guess the strangest of that is continued by the fact that we tend to fly Navy APOCs only as our, you know, stock ship, and obviously they're Bargons and Vindicators, but it's a very Armar based fleet. So since we fly the faction Armar ships, you know, there's a kind of a theme there. So they enjoy that a little bit too. And so, you know, there is a little rapport, I guess, through the fact that we have, or at least some of us have, you know, some roots in an NRDS kind of environment.
Well, you heard it here first, everybody. Rooks and Kings, Armar role players. I think that's fantastic.
Well, you know, if Princess wanted to do some role playing when she does the, you know, the bat phone. Oh, yeah.
So speaking of the triage carrier, you brought that up with your rather humorous anecdote about that proper gentleman. No one in their right mind was using triage carriers until you guys put out Clarion Call. I remember it as clear as day. I was FCing at the time. Not literally in a fleet, but you know, I was an Alliance director, and I was looking out at the landscape, and people were using carriers occasionally. But the wide-ranging convention was that the triage module was a waste of time because it capped your carrier out and you couldn't move it and you were so vulnerable and on and on and on. And then here you came with Clarion Call and you basically broke it down, and we'll have a link for this in the show notes, about not only why triage carrier was amazing by showing what it could do, but you went through step by step. Here's how to fit it. Here's like three or four different situations that it's really good in. And almost within a week, you started seeing triage carriers appearing in other people's fleets, copying your tactics. What started you on the path to triaging, and did you take a lot of flack for trying to base your logistics around the triage concept?
Well, I think the first thing to say would be that, I mean, by the time Clarion Call came out, we'd had a few videos before then where we'd fought RA and TCF, videos like Equinox and, you know, a bit lower profile, where we had shown generally, you know, what triage carriers could do. So, although I guess the video helped popularize it, I mean, some people had, or at least our enemies had somewhat picked up on what triage was about at that point. And at that point, I'd sort of pushed into early versions of Pantheon and also trying to get the triple triage stuff working that we have covered in Ironclad, you know, where you drift in and out of cycle and that kind of stuff, and then the refitting and so on. But in terms of really early days as to why it seemed like a good module, I think it goes back again to the fact that it was this issue of an NRDS region, a little bit the Wild West, where really people didn't fit according to very organized doctrines, didn't really have that many skill points, and we had some pretty, you know, big 0-0 enemies from the big boys who were coming and fighting there. And therefore, we needed, you know, I had to find some way that if I just keep them alive long enough, you know, somehow, then presumably we can do it. And even when the triage was lost in the early days, because obviously we would go through more triage carriers than today in Rooks and Kings, because Foundation didn't have the the ability to escalate as Rooks and Kings can. So I remember one TCF member on the forums talked about it as his first experience of capital suicide, where they charged him with a Tech 2 gang, back when hacks were quite expensive, of course, you know, and they lost like 40 hacks or something, killing the carrier, but the rest of the fleet got out. And at first they were pleased about it, but then they, you know, saw how much damage had actually been done from the fight. And that, I guess, you know, that showed them what triage could do, and also showed the fleet what, you know, what could be achieved. And I guess it also goes to something that I don't know which, whether it's Hilmar or which actual CCP dev actually said that, but one thing that always struck me as a pretty good quote was one of the CCP guys saying that EVE is the only game where you can save your friends. And I guess that because people's ships, you know, it represented a, you know, investment of time and passion to some degree, very fond of their Typhoons back then, I guess that repping their ships out of structure, you know, it did actually help kind of create that sort of strong bond in the Alliance. And I do think that Alliances that are, you know, have a strong logistic backbone tend to internally function better. I mean, to some degree, the mechanics of the combat there do impact on the social structure, and Foundation was, you know, significantly improved as an Alliance through our focus of logistics, even on the personal level, I mean, and the social level.
I think you can see the opposite of that, too. Alliances that don't necessarily trust one another very well, or don't have tight bonds, tend to do poorly at logistics-based combat. I noticed that a lot with EVE University. EVE University is a perfectly fine alliance, but just by the nature of what it is, you know, players will be coming in there, they're new, they don't really know the other players around them, and sometimes the players, when they learn enough, they'll leave and move on to somewhere else. So there's not really an opportunity for tight bonds to be formed outside of their core membership, and when they're on field, they either don't use logistics-based tactics, or if they did have some logistics in the fleet, they wouldn't really trust them very well or protect them very well. And it was definitely noticeable fighting them back in January that, you know, they would break probably earlier than they maybe needed to, or their logistics wouldn't be coordinated and used to talking to one another and just wouldn't be as effective.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that definitely has a strong impact. Although I suppose I should qualify that also by saying that, you know, whilst generally the Foundation guys and GW are always there for each other, that wasn't always true of the mining ops. Now, Eldrath here, I actually met Eldrath back in the GW days, and he was an interceptor pilot. And I mean, you know, Foundation was great. I loved the people I flew with there, and that was fantastic. But none of them could decloak a sausage. I mean, seriously, if a ship jumped into a bubble and we were all sat on the gate and I told the interceptors to go and decloak him, well, first of all, nothing would happen. It would, because everyone would just, you know, rather than actually click in space, they'd just click on the overview. Despite the fact I told them to click in space, they'd just click the overview. And you could see them, like, you know, they'd be like cars just spluttering to a halt. They'd start and then sort of stall and splutter and stop. Then they'd realize what had happened and they'd click somewhere and they'd start burning, usually 180 degrees from where the ship cloaked. And once they got to about 70 kilometers out, they'd start screaming for drones, drones, send me drones. All of this, you know, like 2 minutes after the ship cloaked and has probably warped off and left system. And usually the farce only stopped once the hostile left system, and then people accepted that, you know, they'd missed it. But then enter Eldrath. Now, Eldrath was a completely different beast. Here was a man who could decloak things, which obviously made him a superstar overnight in Foundation and in GW. And, well, we had a mining op where, you know, I guess I wasn't fully committed, looking back, to the safety of the op, because after about 15 minutes I'd got bored and set up these large bubbles on the EO2 gate. And then I tried to play a game where I would jump in with my alt in a covert and then, you know, give prizes or acclaim to whoever got nearest or decloaked me from all the people sitting there. And that person was Eldrath, who was dominating the game completely. Unfortunately, doing this left us somewhat vulnerable to a certain smart bombing Typhoon. I think it was a Typhoon, wasn't it, Eld?
It was, yes.
It was. Well, you should probably finish that.
Yeah, okay, so we're all playing games in our Tech 2 large bubbles, and suddenly a Typhoon warps in amongst all the miners and starts smart bombing away. While our entire defense fleet has 40 kilometers to burn out our bubbles, which obviously isn't entirely helpful. And then all our light tackle didn't want to burn and warp to the belt to tackle the Foon because they get popped by the smart bombs. And so it was just down to all the battleships lumbering out and then warping there, by which time the Typhoon had just warped off and docked at station. And so we managed to lose half our fleet.
And was this before or after the nano nerfs?
After, I believe. I think the nano nerfs happened just before I joined Foundation.
Well, amazing. Now smart bombing Foon remains part of your standard tactics, I recall.
Well, yeah, I mean, these days we have the pipe bombing fleet. Although, I suppose the key there, actually, the Titan is more important than the smart bomber, because what we're essentially doing is maneuvering enough sinos and bubbles to create a situation where we can, you know, portal onto a point in space where we know a fleet will land. And then, obviously, a lot of pipe bombing Foons, as people have seen, can do a lot of damage, even to battleship gangs.
It's known as the poor man's doomsday. Very fun, very tricky to pull off and really anticipate where people are going to be landing. I'm always terrified that one day I'll decide to do that fleet, and like the enemy fleet will be warping, and I'll go, oh great, they're going to land on the bubble, activate the sign, I have all the battleships ready to go, and then it turns out they warp to a tactical, like 150 above, where my fleet is now smart bombing with their dicks in the wind. I'll never to do it again.
And you wake up in a cold sweat.
that did actually happen to us once, I think.
Yep.
Versus Test, I believe, and was it Executive Outcomes in a Drake fleet just behind them?
There was a second fleet too, but it was around 200, like a 200 man Maelstrom gang that we were trying to pipe bomb, yeah.
And it was in full faction battleships as well. Yeah. Not Fleet Foons, it was all Vindicators and Macarials and stuff.
Oh dear.
Yeah, a lot of people had, you know, 10-kilometer smart bombs and that kind of thing. I mean, you know, quite a few ships there were like 20 billion apiece. And these days I try and tone that down a bit, but they, as Eld said, they bounced. And I suppose, if anything, it's maybe fear is not necessarily the right... Well, maybe it is, but the thing is, it's a lesson about, I guess, projecting intent, in the sense that the fleet landed 200 kilometers above us, and we have no guns. We have them in our cargo. We can refit to them theoretically, but it's very difficult to do in practice to refit all your highs, you know, on all the ships that quickly. And they've, you know, they're perfectly set. They're 200 kilometers there, and they can just short warp in and shoot us. But rather than actually do that, they were so pleased at having avoided us that they just, you know, wrote in local about it. You know, they were so pleased to have lived, essentially, that they, you know, just put good fun in local, and they said, you missed us, and were very proud of having dodged the trap. Not realizing, of course, that we were very much concerned with just getting out of there. And we were... Didn't we align to the wrong point as well?
We aligned to one station, which we managed to do quite quickly, like a webbing carrier, so they aligned quicker and whatnot. But then, when we were to fleet warp off, the Damnation pilot fleet warped us to the other station, which was about 160 degrees in a different direction, so we all had to slowly sort of slow down and then sort of realign and warp off in bits and pieces with the carriers last. It was all quite tense.
Did they make it out?
Yes, we did lose the ship. I think we lost the starship. Ship.
And to make matters worse, one Maelstrom did land in our blob, and of course everyone went to kill him with smart bombs, thereby totally giving away the fact that none of us had any guns anyway, and that they could just warp 200 Maelstroms, short warp them in and start killing us. But somehow, you know, we bumbled our way out of the bubbles and eventually got to, well, what was the wrong station, then, well, not the station we tried to get to. But I guess, you know, that's the psychology of Eve, in a sense, that, you know, if you kill a fleet a few times, then eventually they're happy just to get out, sometimes not seizing an advantage when, you know, when it is there in front of them.
Testies are besties, but, yeah, not always the most bloodthirsty and ruthless, efficient killing machines.
Well, I don't know, I think they're doing pretty well with HBC. I mean, they seem to have something good going there.
This was like 2 years ago as well.
That was back when they were still getting their bearings, I think.
Yeah.
Although we did pipe on two test fleets successfully last week. That was good fun.
Well, Alex really kind of summed it up. I mean, you guys are more or less on the forefront of triage warfare, and while after that story this may seem like a bit of a tart question, but what do you guys do to stay sharp, like as an alliance, you know, with your triage logistics and maybe subcaps too?
Sort of taking it in a broad way, for you guys, what is a challenge? Like, it feels like you guys have fought every fleet that could be fought and have tried just about everything. So, like, what do you do to challenge yourselves?
Well, I suppose those are two different questions in a way. In terms of what, well, Eld will have to answer how he keeps sharp. The simple answer as to how I keep sharp is I don't keep sharp. I suspect that, you know, there are a lot of little details in triage, and granted I still obviously have all the SSDs and the technical side of it to load grid fast and that kind of thing, but in terms of keeping sharp, I think what actually happens is that it's more like passing mantle on to other people. So whereas I used to do the triage, and then I was joined with Link, who used to join me doing the triage, and then we had Agent and Shani and Da Vinci and Mesh now coming into the triage stuff as well. And so it's been a long time since I actually was in a triage carrier, and I suspect that if I was in a triage carrier today, I'd do a much worse job than Da Vinci or Agent or Mesh or Link or Shani, or, you know, one of the main five triage pilots we have today. And I assume what will happen is that there'll be, you know, now of course the meta game may change, and, you know, we may be then talking about Guardians or, you know, some other ship that performs that logistic linchpin role. But whatever that role is, presumably the mantle for that role will pass on to someone else in the future as well. So I think you kind of see a progression there where you kind of hand over some of these roles, and I very much doubt that I could do the job anywhere near as well as the main five. And then there are a number of people on the periphery of that who also become very experienced in triage. So I'd say I probably don't keep sharp in that regard. I think what happens instead is that, you know, people go into different roles and new people take up your place there in you know, the mechanics of the combat and in the sort of social aspect of, you know, performing that role in the alliance and in the battles and all. And I mean, that, in a way, that's a great thing about Eve, because that there's something about that which, in a way, you'd expect from a community. You'd expect that as a natural process to happen.
Yeah, you would, wouldn't you, Turtle? I've been trying to get Ninja Turtle to triage in my fleet so I can FC and he can triage, instead of the other way around. Still working on that Archon, aren't you, buddy?
I have a Galente Supercap alt that is completely wasted on Noir, so maybe I can send him over to Rooks and Kings instead.
Perhaps, although we don't use Supercaps as much as people think we do. Oh, we do use Supers. We just don't use them all the time. We just sort of pace them out, and I try not to get too predictable. If you let me go back to the keeping sharp aspect, if you don't mind.
Yes, please.
When training triage pilots, we generally buddy people up, so we have the main four or five people, and then they jump in with like sort of like a newer person who's like just joined. And so if the newer person does make a big mistake, like sort of expensive ships don't just go pop, which helps sort of bed them in a little bit. Also, I think lots of people watch their FAPs back, which I think some people don't do in EVE, which I think is quite helpful. You get to sort of see where your mistakes were and sort of a plan to do stuff better. So I think quite a lot of people in Rooks and Kings all FAPs fights and then sort of go back and view their actions afterwards.
Like game film for football. US yes. Time zone can relate to that.
Yes, indeed.
Our guys starting to do that more often. Especially, I think, Wacktopia or Wacken. What is Wacken? I can't remember which of them posted a video of our last fight, and it's really useful to dissect it. But it's also rough on your computer having to screen cap while you're in the middle of a big EVE fight. I noticed that sometimes you have the fraps running on your triage carriers, and with the reaction time needed for those, you guys must have either some serious rigs, or how do you guys manage that? Or are you just that confident in your abilities that a little bit of lag is no problem?
I think all of the Trios carriers all have SSDs, because it's absolutely critical that they actually like turn off on grid. So while a few battleships not making it through the Titan Bridge because they're on slow computers isn't too much of a deal, having Trios carriers not load or Guardians not load if we're going in with Guardians is a massive issue to us. So all the, well, I'd say all the Trios, but most of the Guardian pilots as well have SSTs, and they've all got rigs that can sort of load grid quickly and not sort of strain under FAPS as well. Lord's quite picky when it comes to logistics pilots and their like sort of PC setups.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a fascist on the PC setups in that sense. That's true. I do get their 3D Mark scores and, you know, make sure they have some pretty serious rigs. And some of the core guys are very into overclocking and water cooling and, you know, make sure they have the absolute best always on the hardware front. Because in a way, you know, it gives them a reason to have, you know, a reason to tweak at the PC and, I guess, you know, have a purpose for that. So I guess that that works in that way as well.
Well, the other side of that question, what do you guys do to challenge yourselves, besides figuring out how you can pimp at your computers anymore?
Could I quickly mention something about the supers as well, actually, to go back
to
that? Well, as Eld said, we don't tend to use supers that often. We wouldn't... Well, put it this way, that Rooks and Kings is very much about using the right tool, you know, for the situation, having the right tool. And we wouldn't drop supers just to get onto some males or to kill something faster. There was a period when, you know, enormous number of capitals we used to fight used to self-destruct. And I actually, you know, put all of that together into a document once and forwarded that to Misa, our CSM rep, just to give to CCP, just to show... The document had screenshots of the self-destruct messages, the dates, that kind of thing. Just to show the sheer volume of the caps that were self-destructing, which was around, I think, around 52% of all the caps we killed had died by self-destruct. And that was in K-space. The number was much higher for wormhole space, of course, where the DPS is lower. And a lot of the time, sometimes even people in fleet would want to try and drop their supers to try and get the mail. But that's something I never really wanted to do, because as far as I'm concerned, you know, it's just about winning the fight, and if we're winning the fight, then obviously we don't need the super on the field, because we have the right tool already, and if it's needed, then we'll call it in.
It's all about risk versus reward in our playstyle, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, that actually paid off for us, because we used to have some big battles sometimes with White Noise and RA and those guys in Ostingle and the systems around there, including one nice fight I remember where Link was newting out an avatar to stop it shooting our triage carrier at the time, while both sides escalated by throwing more caps in. Later on, they actually tried to make a trap for our supers by getting, you know, a massive fleet of capitals together. And previous to that, the week before that, they'd self-destructed a second cap fleet against us. And they probably noticed, you know, that there was a bit of ill feeling about that. And then they probably realized that if, you know, we perhaps might want the males, so if in a similar situation, would we jump our supers? And they tried to make a trap where they would purposely self-destruct. We'd jump our supers in, then they'd cancel self-destruct and jump everything else in and kill us. Which luckily we spotted.
It wasn't hard to spot, though. I mean,
it wasn't hard to spot,
included, though. Like, sort of 10 caps and 3 or 4 supers, and then had like 30 Hicks trailing behind them, so
it's but a
fairly
plan.
Easy map to spot. But yeah, it was a good plan to try and sort
plan.
Of bait out and like sacrifice the first cap fleet to try sort of get a bigger fight.
Yeah, so you always have to keep that in mind. So as a result of that, we were generally careful not to put in supers in situations where they weren't needed. Having said that, though, when we do drop supers, we will, you know, drop them very aggressively. Like we had a big fight against CFC, for example, we dropped them with Titans. I mean, how often does a big CFC fleet get Titan dropped by a 200-man alliance, you know, on a pause timer in a you know, pitched battle? And sometimes, if you're very aggressive like that, it can give you the advantage in the fight. And in that case, killed their cap fleet and routed their fleet. And then, of course, they bat-phoned and tried to keep us there with some dicta bubbles, trying to, you know, throw more and more dictas to the grinder.
While they bat-phoned,
you know, HBC and all of CFC and PL and all those guys. So, and then we had to do that starburst out of the pos to escape at the end. But in situations like that, to win those kind of fights, the Titans, the Supercaps, they play an important role then. So it's generally, they'll generally be deployed in situations where we're counter-dropping, things like that, you know, big pitched battles where they're absolutely needed. I'm not a big fan of throwing something in just to see it on a mail, because, you know, what's the point in the end? It's more fun to see a ship used the right way. And I guess that's something I noticed when I started EVE, that people don't mind losing ships. I don't think they mind losing ships generally in EVE, players in EVE. I think what bothers them is losing ships the wrong way, feeling that their ship wasn't used to its maximum. If a ship's used to its maximum, it's killed, or, you know, it was the right tool at the right moment, but the battle was lost. I don't think that bothers anyone. I think that just becomes part of their EVE narrative, and they accept that and even enjoy that, and it's, then they're happy to grind for another ship or just buy another ship or whatever.
The difference between having your interdictor dying on the way to a big fight to a gate camp versus dying, dropping a bubble that traps the enemy fleet that makes this amazing fight happen.
Yeah, I think that's the difference. Really, people don't mind losing a ship. They just don't like losing a ship without feeling that it was used to its potential.
What do you guys do for a challenge, though?
Well, I think there's still a lot of challenges around. I'm not someone, and I mean, Eld would have to give his own perspective on that, but I would potentially regard any fleet as a threat in the sense that, you know, I don't look at an alliance's reputation and say, well, you know, they're only so-and-so alliance, it's not going to be a problem. Because after all, people probably said that, you know, in the old days about Foundation before, you know, when they killed the Ratters of Foundation and then ran into the kind of inner core. And it's often like that in EVE, you know, the people who are at the bottom of the ladder today could be at the top a year from now. So you never really know. All it takes is one or two good people at the center of an organization suddenly to transform it, and you have a viable fighting force. So I still think of any fleet as a challenge in that sense. I try not to underestimate anyone, actually. Now, maybe that's just EVE has made me paranoid after all these years. You know, it might be mental illness more than caution. I don't know. But I try not to underestimate anyone. I still regard, you know, any, like, whatever fleet we fight, let's say this week or next week, I'll still regard that as a challenge, whether they are a very well-known PvP alliance or whether they're lesser known.
Well, do you have anything to add to that?
Aside from the sort of lol fleets and like just fig worms and stuff, we do try and sort of plan out what like hostiles sort of might do, like to counter like the situation they find themselves in, and so we plan counters against that, and so perhaps we do over engineer fights a little bit, but I think that, I mean, we've run into some fights before where we've been overconfident. There's one time, if you don't mind me mentioning, Lord, with the was it Nulli Secunda carriers, where we got so used with like him, I think it was 2 or 3 months beforehand, we just sort of won every fight and just sort of weren't really being challenged a lot, and so we overextended ourselves. We saw, I think, 28 carriers repping a POS, and so we decided to sign in with, was it 9 battleships and 1 triage carrier right on top of them?
I think it was 8 battleships and a triage.
8 battleships.
Yeah. And we expected them to run.
Yes.
And they did. They did initially run. That's...
Yeah. So sort of all the carriers all burnt with the shield. We tackled a few outside, but unfortunately we tackled too many. And once they realised that it was only actually 9 battleships and a triage carrier, all the other carriers just sort of came back out, ripped the guy who was in half armour, and just like killed our fleet. So I think underestimating people is sort of like a big mistake, which gets lots of fleets killed. But if you sort of plan for what other people might do, and sort of like, even if it is a gank, sort of if it could have happened, then it's good that you thought about that situation. It keeps you sharp.
Certainly.
I if that makes any sense.
That is the only anecdote you will ever hear of Rooks and Kings tackling too many targets. That simply does not happen. We can't tackle anything. And usually we'll fail to tackle everything. But the only positive thing to that, the only silver lining, is the fact that I then can look forward to Eld's rage once he discovers how many dreads have warped out. And I can, you know, the excitement of seeing which vegetable-based metaphor he'll throw at us is it kind of counterbalances the sense of loss of all the males, of all the things that warp out.
You guys need to invest in interceptors, man.
Well, that's the thing. We very rarely have. We sometimes have Hicks, but, you know, generally speaking, because we have to kind of maximize with the numbers we have, most people will tend to be in pretty heavy stuff. And I suppose, you know, if hostiles warp off, it's not as bad as losing the fight. So maybe there's a gentlemanly thing there, you know, that once the opponent is bested, you know, one should let them walk off the battlefield. But the truth is, we just can't tackle anything sometimes, some days.
Yes, there we have more than one Dictor and fleet, and I think you Mads usually turn up with a few extra Dictors and Interceptors, but as the main Rooks and Kings people go, we leave all the tackling to, like heavy tank T3s, and don't really bother with much else. It's normally John Caffeine and his Hick and Vandal, who just sort of keep targets like pinned down for us.
I've learned the value of having a Scepter, even in our armor hack fleets. Guardians, Zealots, and all that sort of stuff. Always pays to have at least two of them, I've found, if you have the people to spare, which, you know, sometimes is not always the case, more it's just, this is all that guy can fly, but I do notice that having them there tends to be invaluable, getting those kills that would otherwise escape us, especially when we're trying to track damage against a particular target for a contract. Letting them run off the field is not the best feeling in the world. So, having them run away and then realize that there are still two targets 60 kilometers away from us that can't leave. Like, yes! More males!
Yeah, indeed, I can imagine. I mean, there are times we'll get people to, you know, board Hicks and things that we keep on carriers. But generally speaking, obviously, we can be quite light on the tackling, so that can be a factor. So distributing points sometimes can go wrong. But lots of things can go wrong, really, in Rooks and Kings fleets. I mean, people have the impression sometimes that things never do, but I can assure you there's a certain amount of fail that always creeps in. In fact, it's an internal battle against fail, I suppose. That's life in Eve, isn't it? Like bumping carriers into shields. I mean, that happens surprisingly often. I remember one of our Russian players, I won't name him, because he's a fantastic pilot, and, you know, fantastic solo pilot too, very skilled. But one day it was just that day, and I guess he just got out of bed that morning knowing that he was going to bump a carrier into a shield, and he just no way to divert him from that path. We signaled in, and I think it was a Chimera off the shields.
It was very close.
The scent point was almost touching, so it was one where we really had to just rely on the Vindicators to hold him and just nuke him with damage, and we had a lot of damage. There was no real call to bump him anyway. And we Sino in, and we're, you know, fire's raining down on this Chimera, and he's dying fast. And suddenly from the back of the pack near him, it's like a Harley rumbling into life. You can just see this Vindicator, you know, spinning up and starting to accelerate towards him. And we all know it's going to happen. I think Josie is the first one to call
to do
it.
Anything.
It's just too late. Too late. It's
brought too much momentum. You can't stop the ship.
You can't stop it. You can't stop the ship. You can't even stop the situation. We just sit there, just speechless, knowing what's going to happen. And probably even he knows it. And I guess just closes his eyes and, you know, puts the pedal to the floor. And he just burns straight at this carrier, bangs it on the nose, and it's straight back in the shield. And you just can't stop that some days. It's just an unstoppable force.
We signed in, and there was like five carriers repping a small POS, but I'd forgot to replenish my sabers interdictor bubble, so I had like two left in my like sort of bubble launcher, so I was frantically trying to contract some more bubbles, like to my out, to take to the Titan to Sino in and give to my Dicto, and But unfortunately, I double-clicked in space just before I opened the contact menu, so there's these carriers bubbled. I think we had five or six of them in this small pos, and my dict is burning away, and I'm frantically trying to contact it, and I can't find my alt's name. I contacted it to myself by accident, and then it just turned out that sort of I've burned like 80 kilometers away and have to turn around and end up just catching one. Like as a vessel sano out, and just things like that always happen. It's just sort of, we know better than other alliances sometimes with regards to tackling and not bumping things, but
probably worse indeed.
I think, but when it comes to sort of just sort of being organised and sort of laying down damage and like keeping the logistics up, that's where most alliances shine when the sort of shit hits the fan, so to speak.
Yeah, the best moments are always. In fact, I guess it's no coincidence that all the recent videos are situations where we've either dropped or been somewhere and then we get dropped on. And then it's that sense of having to reorganize under pressure, which is... it's a bit like that scene in the Philip Pullman Dark Materials trilogy when the armored bears get attacked by the witches from the air, and then they have to... Their sergeant calls them to reorganize, and they ready the fire hurlers to return fire. And those situations are often the best in EVE, where you know you get jumped on, and you've only got these tools right there on the field, and somehow you have to turn that into something that can win the fight. And those are the moments, I guess, where people shine, where they're called on to do something, for sure. Although I've just remembered on that bumping the carrier anecdote, another example of that actually. Do you remember? Munora, but it was his first op, his first day in Rooks and Kings. First day at the office. Yep, and he sounded you know, very competent, and you know, we had full trust in him, and we signed
him for a few months as well.
Yeah. And he'd done perfectly. And his first op, first day at the office, we sino in, it's a carrier on the edge of the shield, totally regulation situation, nothing big about it. And for whatever reason his fleet foon suddenly just the moment he arrives, he just charges straight at this carrier, almost before we can get put any damage down, and knocks it back on the straight back in the shield. And there's complete silence on TeamSpeak, because no one knows what to say, and he doesn't know what to say. And he later said his heart was in his mouth, and just couldn't believe it had happened. But then, despite all of that, somehow, this carrier suddenly starts turning, and he's bumped it a good 4K into the shield, it starts turning, and then its nose just re-emerges from the shield. And I remember he was talking about, you know, his pure relief when this happened, because it seems the carrier was AFK and actually orbiting the tower. So the carrier itself flew back out, and, you know, the day was saved for him, and he killed it. And, you know, he's a great guy. He's a fantastic pilot. And, you know, it's normally, it'd be much more likely to happen to me than to him. You know, he's certainly probably more on the ball. But, you know, these things happen sometimes, and I guess things like that, just, you know, they're part of the EVE experience. I mean, the stuff that goes wrong can be as entertaining as the stuff that goes right in the end. You know, it's all content, it's all narrative, it's, you know, it all ends up in the stories like now that we'll talk about, so.
That's an excellent transition to our contract wrap-ups. So we did not actually take any contracts, because we wanted to get in on basically AAA falling apart. Specifically, Impasse. It has long been a dream of mine to have like a deep 00, like central trade hub outpost type thing. Open it up to everybody, have it be a nice big fight clubby type area, and then secretly sell arms to people inside the station and make tons of money. So we were like, alright, Impasse, perfect for this. We did a quick check on the map. You can basically black ops the entire region from one system. So you're like, okay, great. We're going to wormhole in all of our black ops battleships, and we'll make a party out of it. Go in there. Got SBUs. SBU 68FT, like AAA's main system. And Cass Dyson said that he had unlined them, but I guess he had just anchored them, because AAA flipped the SBUs. Now this is in between us blowing up things like Billionist Gratting Tengus and things like that. Once the SBUs got flipped, you're like, ah, fine. So we go blow one of them up. And there are, I think, five gates, six gates in that system. you need 3 SBUs. So we blew up one SBU and SBU'd 2 other gates, plus the other one. But we didn't actually get a chance to drop them, because it was getting late. So, Jagged Alliance came in and dropped them. This is before all the HBC drama. Jagged Alliance was going to take Impasse, apparently. But they never cleared with me, so I saw their SBUs anchored but not online, and I was like, well, mine now. I went up to each of them with my stealth bomber, or my rapier rather, and I flipped them. So now we had NOR SBUs onlining in 68 FT, and quite quickly we were comboed by Jagged Alliance, who were under the impression that AAA had hired us to harass their attempt to take Sov in Impasse. Which we got a chuckle out of, considering the people we were killing were AAA. It was a big mess, and eventually it turned out that they basically paid us off. Said, well, we'll help you with another station in the region, as long as we get to 68 FT and you blew us up and stopped bothering us. So, considering that it would take us like 100 hours to grind a station with our fleet size, we were like, okay. And, yeah. Fortune favors the bold, particularly in Eve, but unfortunately, it also is very painful for the stupid, and Jagged Alliance's executor got caught with his hand in the cookie jar in terms of RMTing and taking on AAA renters, which Test Alliance did not appreciate, and they're having a lot of problems with the HBC right now, and eventually it became quite clear that they would not be able to actually live up to their side of the bargain. And with that being the case, we reset them, and we came back. And now we're going to spend a little time with Tech Shield, who had trapped us in a mutual war from what we were talking about in our previous episode with Dark Taboo and their war deck, and deciding to bring in Deck Shield after they lost a 4 billionist tower. So now we finally get a chance to go and enjoy all the free wars that we've been getting notifications for the past 2 weeks. It would have been fun, though. I was really starting to get excited about the idea of having a station like that. No one's really tried it in quite a long time.
I'm a little disappointed, a little too disappointed right now to talk about it.
No, the dream has not died. Perhaps someday. There are a bunch of stations that are perfect for that sort of thing. 9UI is one of them, although that's a bit shallower in Empire. CEVA would probably slaughter a calf to the gods before they let anybody take it after all they went through to get it in the first place.
NOR Academy is now recruiting. We are looking for smart players who are looking to learn small gang PvP in an immersive training environment. In a program designed for new pilots as well as grizzled 00 vets, learn the ins and outs of merc life, including efficiency and ethics, hostile nullsec survival skills, FCing and more. As one of Eve's oldest and most respected mercenary outfits, NOR runs a tight ship, but we always strive to have fun doing it. If you want to be part of a high-end merc PvP organization that always strives to be better tomorrow than it is today, NOR is the place for you, and NOR Academy is the place to start. Apply today through our forums at NORmercs.com.
As far as this week in Mercs, what have the other mercenaries been up to? As far as I can tell, jack shit. Wars are basically ground to a halt. Nobody's doing anything of particular note. I think everybody just sort of has their breath held in their chest till December 4th, when hopefully we'll get some sort of look at the war deck mechanics. Talk a little bit about that in the CSM wrap-up. And if not December, then certainly by the Retribution 0.1 patches, there's going to be something done, and I think people are pretty much just waiting and seeing for that to happen. But if your mercenary group does have something interesting going on, or has a good story to tell us, feel free to let us know here at the podcast, declarationsofwar.com, Alexiv Card, Ninja Turtle, drop us a mail. We're happy to tell your story, advertise your service, whatever. Eve news. Let's go into it with this. Let's take the Jagged Alliance item first. Finally, we have some drama in the otherwise monolithic Honey Badger Coalition. Jagged Alliance decided to take Renners from AAA for income, obviously. A notoriously anti-renting alliance. Tess did not appreciate one of their, I guess, coalition mates, junior coalition mates, making that kind of decision, and not kicked them out exactly, but just sort of an awkward half reset. I don't really know what to make of it, but I don't like Jagged Alliance's chances for continued 0-0 residence. The 2.5 standing set also came with a non-invasion pack, which, admittedly, the guy that brought up this point in the leaked Jagged Alliance meeting was sort of a raving lunatic. But it does seem weird that you have a blue with a non-invasion pact. It's sort of... you would think it would almost go without saying. I suspect they will not remain blue for long.
Well, it seemed like they were going through those timers and impasse fairly quickly. I guess maybe I had slightly higher hopes than you did, but I mean, they were definitely suffering from the same kind of time zone problems we were, and definitely around the same times we were, so it wasn't really a situation where we could back up that empty hole in theirs. You know, we worked together when we were all on, and then things would just kind of slow down.
They did have people, other alliances helping them, alliances way bigger than us, guys like Cha-Ching and Unclaimed, or other HBC alliances. And it seems like they're going to be sticking with Jagged no matter what Tess does. So we might have, I don't know, like a mini block forming there. They seem pretty tight at the time. We were only with them for, what, a week, week and a half? So I have no idea, but they seem like they were really getting along. So I don't know if Tess completely exiles them, but that's going to change the political dynamic down in Impasse Phythobolus, but... certainly I don't see Tess coming to their aid if anybody except perhaps AAA attacks them. Speaking about the other end of space, Vale of the Silent and that whole war is pretty much done. We talked about it on the last podcast that Tribute Defense had essentially dissolved with NCDOT breaking off relations with their largest coalition mate, Black Legion. And now it's officially done. NCDOT has vacated the North pretty much. Goons bought Evoke's Tech Moon holdings for $250 billion. Evoke is evacuating. I believe they paid some of that money to NCDOT to get them to change all their timers to a more convenient time for Goons 1's fleets. And yeah, that's all she wrote. Goonswarm's pretty much going to spend the rest of their time, probably till the end of the year, just cleaning up all their new holdings, making sure their passes are set up, getting their supply chain set up, getting a jump bridge network set up, I assume will be part of their priority list. And after that, who knows? But they've said that Geminate will not be on the table, at least not for a while. As for Evoke, apparently they're going to be moving towards Syndicate or Outer Ring, or possibly both. And who knows what they'll be doing from there, but can imagine that they will not be quiet for long. It's a very rich, old, powerful alliance with one of the largest supercap fleets in the game, so I don't think they're going to be sitting still for long. Has Rooks and Kings ever fought Evoke?
Yes, I believe we have in Outer Ring a few years ago, wasn't it? We had a nice slug match, about 50 versus 70 battleships.
Yeah, we had some nice fights with Evoke. We also had a fight in lighter stuff against them, also went very well, I recall. But they're good fun to fight. I mean, they really, in the past, have been up for the fight, and it's a shame that we don't live in that area at the moment, actually, because Syndicate and Outer Ring were, you know, previously within our hot drop range, let's say, so we're kind of missing out there. That's quite intriguing, really, if they're based there.
Well, it's preliminary. I don't know if they're actually going to do it, or if they do it long term, but it'll definitely be a shake-up for that area, as I recall from the last time we were there, which, you know, granted was a while ago, there weren't any large, like, Sov-level alliances hanging around. So it's going to be interesting to see what that does for the PvP in that area.
It wasn't quite to the point where large Sov-holding alliances had to be living there.
Yeah, I think the last time there was a big Sov holding, you know, big 0-0 style alliance was when Fatal Ascension were there over the summer. We had some good fights with them. So if Evoke based there, that would certainly be very interesting for the region. And if they do, I mean, I hope that Evoke do well there. I mean, they're a very old alliance now in EVE, and generally, well, the EVE landscape would be lesser without Evoke. So hopefully, whatever troubles they have at the moment in terms of the political situation or having to relocate and so on, hopefully that they find some way to base and go from there. Certainly a very good alliance.
And back to the south, and sort of back to the Honey Badger Coalition. Fighting continues between Solar Fleet and AAA and the Gypsy Bands Coalition, with apparently Honey Badger Coalition being a regular third party in a lot of these fights. I guess it's out of boredom, like they're not content just doing structure grinds, they want to actually get some fleet fighting, and this is where fleet fighting is going on in the south. But, you know, it could also be looked at that Solar is paying the price for being closely aligned to AAA. But I don't know if that's really going to be consequential, because I don't think Honey Badger Coalition is going to be looking to sort of kick Solar out, at least certainly not in the near term. I think they're just there for the fights.
Yeah, most recently, C-Tech J6 and Innsmother, which is historically a pretty Russian system, Red Alliance before Solar, and yeah, that was their latest showing up. HVC came up, and the numbers were pretty much even, minus the Honey Badgers, and then, I mean, once they came, it was at least 2-1.
CJ is a famed system. I believe that was the original Red Alliance headquarters system, if that's the one I'm thinking of. So it's cool that they have it back. I think if any alliance deserves, like, has entitlement to a particular system, it would definitely be Red Alliance and CJ.
Yep, Solar lost sovereignty today, so...
Yeah, I don't see them keeping it. That's really a question of how much space those alliances want to take from them, I think. But further complicating the political situation down south, you also have the elements of the former Dapros Coalition and AAA Southern Coalition coming together for a, we're not quite sure how to name, coalition that's going to be taking former AAA holdings, mostly in the Tenerifus and Phythobolus areas. It's got Nully, it's got NC Dot, Pangu's in there, and our Broco members, Mildly Intoxicated and Echoes of Nowhere, have joined this. They're expanding their holdings down south, which is cool to see.
Among others, Kadeshi's in there too.
Right.
I like Helna, that's good. I've also heard them called N cubed, N to the third, is how you would see the logo.
Yeah, I like Helna, out of the two of them. Well, with Mildly and Echoes in the mix, we'll probably have something to do with that coalition down the line, I'm sure.
That's cool, I'm happy for Nully. They deserve, like, a decent bunch of people to fly with that, like, actually respects them and treats them well. God fucking forbid.
Yes. Such a crazy idea. And in non-Nullsec Sov news, there have been some interesting changes to the HUD on the Buckingham test server. Basically taking the square brackets with the three bars of hit points below them to a circular bracket style with the hit point bars actually being part of the layout. I've not tested this, but I have seen the videos. Turtle or LM or Eldereth, have you guys had a chance to go on the test server and try these out?
I have not, no. I've seen the videos.
Yeah, I actually have some strong feelings on the HUD stuff.
Spurg away.
First of all, I should say that today I've seen a new HUD design, which I quite like. Previously, what I reacted to was a very, very well-made, very stylish HUD. And by HUD here, I'm referring to the actual target information boxes that show the shield, armor, and structure of the ship, rather than the new boxes in space, which I quite liked even originally. But this, the circles that were introduced recently in the HUD, I thought was a slightly dangerous move, essentially. And I did a little experiment where I took a screenshot of a damnation in structure with the three lions, you know, the three traditional lions we have. And then I took a screenshot with the circles of a ship in structure where I think it had, I don't have the screenshot to hand now, but it had one side, the right side, had gone red.
So you're talking about the previous circle?
Yeah, the previous one.
Okay.
Which was split into three.
The split into three, and they were sort of ringed around the ship.
Exactly. And I took those two images to someone who didn't play Eve, but I explained basically the concept, you know, the fact that ship has health and it has shield armor and, you know, that kind of thing. And I asked them to just look at the two images and describe what they actually interpreted from there. And the three lines, they got completely correct. The three lines, they understood that it represented somehow internal damage because it was the lowest line and it was partly red. But the circle, they got wrong because they thought that because it was red on the side, it meant the ship had taken damage to the side of the ship, but they didn't know what kind of damage. Now, obviously, within 2 minutes, one could explain to someone what the HUD represented and how that worked. But why obfuscate that and put that layer between the person and the information? Because in a sense, and certainly for me making Eve videos, some of the viewers won't be people who play Eve. I mean, I can tell from the comments, you know, some of them will say things like, I don't understand exactly what's going on, but this game looks very interesting, and comments along those lines. And it's a bit more difficult to tell a story if the information isn't easily interpreted from the outside. And in a sense, Eve is a very complicated game. I think we have a sort of responsibility to try and convey as clearly as possible what's actually going on in the game. Especially in that regard, target health information is the bread and butter of what one group of people is doing to another group of people, which in a way is the core of the game. Think how much all of us here in the channel, we've looked at three lines and how much those three lines have represented during our evenings as we've willed, you know, one line to kind of wash over with red in these battles. That's really what we're looking at. We're looking at three lines. So these three lines are really quite important in the same way that the hit noise in Call of Duty is very important to the experience. Activision have an entire audio team who work just on the hit noise of Call of Duty. But obviously it's important because it's, you need to know when you hit someone. That's the core of the game mechanic. I think, therefore, the small things matter. It's difficult to say how much, but obviously the hit noise in COD or the rocket jump in Quake or the satisfying ratchet sound when you pull an AK-47 in Counter-Strike, these are all small details, but the devil is in the details in these things. So I think when you start changing something as fundamental as the health bars on the ships, as the way we interpret our actions, because essentially we see the net result of our actions in those health bars, that's in a sense the feedback we get from the hours we put into Eve, whether we can get those bars to wash go from white to wash over to red. It's a very big deal to mess with that. We've got to be very careful not to reduce even slightly the amount of information flowing to the player, because really, you know, what draws people to Eve. I don't think that having a more flashy interface, even made by a very, you know, very skilled designer, I don't think that anyone's going to watch an Eve video on YouTube and think, wow, you know, that's a fantastic HUD, I'm going to play this game. I think realistically what draws people to Eve are the stories, tales of, you know, conquest or thefts and battles and mercenaries like yourselves and all of this drama in the Eve sandbox. That's what draws people in. So if you obfuscate information, basic information, even very slightly, it makes telling Eve stories that tiny bit harder. And that's dangerous. It's not like it will take anyone very long to adjust to using the circles. And I mean, that sounds like a you know, euphemism for taking an exotic drug using the circles. But I think you've got to be careful where it's not just reinventing the wheel. Functionality isn't always equal. And the previous HUD they had was not in terms of the simplicity of the information presented, wasn't as functional as what we had before. And I think that was very dangerous because it took a bit longer to read. It wasn't as precise, of course, trying to guesstimate how far into a circle versus into a line. And it was more difficult for someone on the outside to interpret. So I think that was a very dangerous change, and I was quite against that. Luckily, though, I really like the new one they've put on. I think that, at least from what I've seen of it so far, which is only a little clip in a video, I'll actually have a look at it on the test server, and then my view might change, I don't know. But this at least seemed to, because it actually mirrored the health on the ship in the central HUD, actually made sense, and in some ways could be even easier to interpret from the outside, because the health of your own ship is presented the same way as the health of the target ship. So it's a simple change, but I quite like the new one. I was very against the old one. I think the old HUD was even quite dangerous for Eve, because I think you've got to be very, very careful when you tinker with core things like these three little lines to which we devote so much of our willpower and passion and energy. And if you do change things at the very core of the game like that, you have to be very careful.
It's definitely an argument of form versus function, and you put it that way. And the devil certainly is in the details, because you need to be able to balance the visual form with the tactical function of it. And I'm not sure that there's a connection with CCP there. I think there's a disconnect in how they're actually handling the changes to it. And I do agree with you. I hated the old one. I thought it was terrible, and you're right, dangerous. The new one is a little bit better, but the visual changes to things that we don't need visually changed, I think it definitely rings a bell. And let's be specific about what we need to change and be careful about it.
Well, like you guys, I didn't like the original implementation of the circle one, and I said so when they brought it to the CSM. It just, I didn't know that it felt it was dangerous, but I certainly felt it was confusing. I mean, if you looked at it, there was no way to tell, like, which bar was armor, which bar was shield, which bar was structure, and whether they were depleting from left to right or right to left, or whether it was even the same for each bar. So I didn't quite like it, but having seen the new video, I actually like it better than the current square one. It's just more economical in terms of screen space, and I think there's a very important point that LM just brought up. You look at your own ship, and that's how you see, you know, whether your ship is healthy or not. Whether your armor is falling off your ship at a rapid clip or not. And to have that same dynamic on the enemy ship when you're locking them, it's a very small and subtle change, but I think it'll help new players understand that information a bit easier. Not that it's a difficult concept to grasp, but anything you can do to lower the Eve learning curve on some unnecessary shit is good, I think.
That's true, but then still a big part of this game is still the storyteller aspect, you know. And I said it earlier today somewhere on the forums that, you know, the number of people that are actually making videos and decent quality videos is getting really big, and it's constantly growing. People love the storytelling aspect of it, and it's something that CCP, I think, is accounting for in their designs, which is kind of cool to see, but there's going to be a balance there, because you're never going to have the form you want as a storyteller with the function you want as a person who actually plays the game. Like, you're going to have to find some middle ground.
Certainly. It was not the only change that CCP unveiled. They also laid out new battlecruiser and command ship changes, which I'm certain Lord Mal has an opinion on as well. Particularly the gang links, which will affect organizations like Rooks and Kings and Noir quite considerably. Essentially, command ships are getting the fleet and field classifications erased, and now you're just going to have command ships. And they're each going to be able to carry, I believe it is, two links, with the Tier 3, or Tech 3 ships, rather, being able to carry three links. And they're each going to have different bonus strengths, of course, with slightly different combat roles. But it's quite a big change over how it is now, and especially with a possible removal of off-grid links. Very controversial.
I think I was probably one of the last few people that preferred command ships over T3s, but this might seal the deal.
What did you think, guys?
I think from a Evox and King's perspective, it won't affect us too much since our command ships are on grids all the time. I know, anyway, we don't use T3 off-grid boosters too much. Maybe the odd person's Loki, but I mean, it wouldn't affect our style of gameplay too much. I do think it'll affect the solo gameplay quite a lot if the off-grid things are removed.
What about the change from going from one link to two on the command ships and from three? Or, from three links to two on the command ships and from essentially one to three on the tech threes? Do you see you guys adjusting the way you distribute gang bonuses?
Not really. I mean, at the moment, occasionally we use a four-slot damnation instead of a three-gang link by using the command processor. I assume, even though it's down to two, you can still fit a command processor to fit an extra link on, so it'd be the standard sort of three-link, like, damnation as usual. So, I don't think it'll affect it too much. I mean, I'll have to refit my Tech 3 sort of Legion booster away now, because I've made a sort of combat-y version. But, I mean, I don't think it'll affect us too much, or all main fleets. I mean, quite a lot of fleets have their sort of fleet bonuses on grid as anchors and stuff anyway, as it is, so, and have lots of spare ones. So, I think the most people it will hit, like, or the people it will hit the worst would be the sort of solo PvPers who have, like, gang link outs and stuff.
Yeah, I think it would affect them much more. Generally, we're signoing into a battle, or we're in a situation where it's often not practical to get a Tech 3 off-grid to safety anyway, so we're often using the command ships quite a lot. And beyond that, too, Princess likes to fly her command ship and give bonuses, and, well, if you want Princess to warp off-grid at the start of the fight, good luck.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm going to have to see actual numbers before I say whether we're going to stick with using command ships, which is our usual, or perhaps moving to Tech 3s for boosting, because we're going to be able to fit more gang links, possibly with more combat ability. Or maybe the command ships are going to have the stronger combat ability. It's really going to depend on the numbers that come out.
I hope this isn't the end of command ships. It's a fun class of ship to fly. Like, I love sitting in my Claymore.
I've been in a damnation. I'm quite happy in it. Do utility things like bait tackling and smart bombing and nuding and just making myself a general pain. So I don't want that to quite go away, although having it turn into a ham DPS boat also has its attractiveness. I love the heavy assault missile as a weapon system, so wouldn't say no to that. But is it still going to be able to provide the support to my fleet that it's essentially in there to do? I don't know. I don't know if command processors are going to maintain the same role that they do now. They haven't announced any changes to them, so like Al said, I would assume so, but perhaps they will adjust that, since they're being very specific about the number of links that each ship is going to use. I hope not, but you never know.
I'd hope not either, because, I mean, that having three links, and that's pretty much just telling you that, like, we don't want you to have all three links at any given time. It's a dick move. Dick move.
Hear that, Fozzy? Dick move. Now we'd like to talk about our second sponsor for this episode, Wunderbet.com. This is Wunderbet, Wunder-bet.com. They're specifically starting up this week, featuring betting for the New Eden Open, the $10,000 tournament that is going to be happening this weekend. Going to have the first rounds. And you can place bets on all those matches. They're also going to be offering bets in the future on things like the Alliance Tournament, Dust Tournaments, and potentially some smaller events. Follow them on Twitter, at Wunderbet, or Facebook, /Wunderbet. Wunderbet, I guess. And they're going to have tons of promotions going on, credits and bonuses for registering and things like that. So definitely check them out. Maybe go buy a Plex over at Eve Time Code, and then you come bet said Plex and Wunderbet and make yourself a Titan. Who knows?
Hashtag disposable income.
Moving on to CSM coverage. We had a lot of work going on with the whole stakeholder process. As you recall from the last episode, the CSM have not been pleased with how that's going. We finally got the meetings that we were looking for from CCP, and it does seem that after their personnel shakeups, they are remaining committed to the process. Just some unfortunate timing with people being promoted and some people leaving and new people coming in, kind of thing. Just didn't get started on as strong of a foot as we would have liked, but we're sort of hopefully back on track now. It feels better anyway. And hopefully we'll have more to tell you about that going forward. The other big piece of news is a bunch of spurging about Wardex. As most people that listen to this podcast will know, there is an alliance called Deck Shield, whose sole existence is to promote the fact that there are tons of exploits in the Wardex system. And we talked about them a little bit last episode with regards to Dark Taboo. And they have a post in the Assembly Hall, which is an old forum that no one uses anymore except people that like to troll for the most part, where they went through what their exploit that they're primarily using is and what their preferred fix would be for it. Now, somebody, I'm not going to give his name out, but some dude decided that more was needed in terms of awareness and decided to spam not only the CSM, but like a dozen other people, if not more, with this email saying, hey, how come you haven't looked at this thread and responded to it, and when are you fixing Wardex and all this stuff, blah, 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 blah. Like, oh my god, okay. So I basically sent the oh my god, okay, back to him, because the secret with Deck Shield is nothing that they're doing is really new. We knew it was a problem going into Inferno. It was brought up to CCP as a problem at the CSM Summit and on the Inferno feedback threads. And supposedly wards were up for some kind of iteration in this coming retribution patch. Now, CSM had been trying to get CCP to say what exactly they were going to do, but the idea that no one was aware of the problem was pretty laughable. But Hans Jaeger Blitzen, being the kind-hearted soul that he is, decided to go into that thread and gave people an update about, you know, what we were doing and what CCP was doing, just trying to make nice with everybody. And
he's a gentleman.
He is a gentleman. Predictably, the trolls ate him alive. And I came in there to throw down, and, you know, me throwing down some forum trolls is always good stuff. It got heated with one dude from a particular alliance, so I'll not name. You can go check out the thread if you want. Claiming that he could learn Eve's code and make a balanced Wardex system that favored attackers as well as respected defenders, and that everybody at CCP and Eve would be cool with, and have it all tested and everything ready to go in less than 4 days. Why hasn't CCP done anything about it? It'd be such a simple change. And you're like, oh boy. I loved that post so much, I showed it to some of the people in CCP. In particular, one of the devs working on Wardex, CCP Puncturus, posted in the thread and trolled the guy a little bit. Which Puncturus loves to do, if you follow her posting. Well, CCP's first response is to make fun of our concerns? I've never seen so many butthurt whiners in my life. And it was getting ridiculous. And so I was having a good time trolling them. Puncturus came back and trolled them again a little bit. So finally it got to the point where someone in CCP was like, actually like, well, here's what's actually going down, and oh by the way, this dev that you're like complaining about so much is totally disrespecting the players, she's the one that's writing all these changes for you. And some of the players that were making fun of her actually mailed her a personal apology over the whole thing. So, yeah. Good times were had. And hopefully this entire event will serve as one more reminder to CCP of why they should close the Assembly Hall Forum. The CSM doesn't read it, really. We have features and ideas for actual ways to improve the game. So Assembly Hall is really a forum that's designed to let people vent, and specifically people who are either not informed enough to know that no one actually reads the Assembly Hall Forum, and hasn't for the past 2 years, since the CSM doesn't pass legislation, essentially, that like it used to. Or they don't care, and they want to troll anyway. And whine anyway.
I know Hans is never going to read it again.
I mean, when Isler Danes is telling you it's probably not the best place to complain to CCP, yeah, take it seriously. No one reads it, not even Isler Danes. Just stop it. And if you're not stopping it, it's a pretty good indication that you're not to be taken seriously. So I think CCP should do everybody a favor and just axe that forum, because I don't see the CSM sliding back to having to vote on particular proposals that are made in Assembly Hall and get them added to the CCP backlog for at least another 3 or 4 years. And you know what? 3 or 4 years from now? Sure, come back to it. In the meantime, it's just a forum that's a cesspool. At least one new player wandered into that thread and almost quit the game over it. I actually mailed him personally to try to explain what the forum was and what was going on, and that the CCP representative in there wasn't really disrespecting the players, he's just having a bit of fun. Here's all the positive things that she and her team are doing. Once it was all explained, that made perfect sense to said player, and hopefully he'll be buying a subscription. But, I mean, it's just not good for anybody that's important. Why it still exists, I don't know.
Get him into a chat with Hans. Hans will talk him down, soothing gently back 2 hours into the game.
I took care of it. I can be nice. Sometimes.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, sure. Occasionally. But it was such a brilliant breakdown of all the personalities in the CSM. You know, Hans deferentially engaged with them. I told them to fuck off. Elise explained things, you know. It was just a very picturesque, all told. So, yeah, that was my highlight of my week, is on the forums, definitely. This has been Declarations of War, episode 38. Go to declarationsofwar.com to participate in the show polls, leave a comment, or please put in a donation to the site. This podcast is listener-supported, and the donations, recurring donations, and sponsorships all help pay for hosting, editing, and cool things we hope to bring you in the future. You can reach Noir via our public channel, CafeNoir.com, and apply to join us or Noir Academy on our forums, www.noirmerks.com. Much thanks to our Rooks and Kings folks, and definitely check out their videos. I'm going to be linking them to you in the show notes. And if you find them in local, run for your lives. And that is all.